Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced. This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we talk with jazz saxophonist and composer Benjamin Boone and find out about his new CD featuring the poetry of Philip Levine, as well as some of the top stars in the jazz world today. We'll also get an update on the controversy brewing in Madera County between District Attorney David Lynn and the Board of Supervisors there, one that's made it all the way to the California Department of Justice. We begin, though, with an update on some reporting we brought you last year. More than 300 California communities lack access to clean drinking water. A disproportionately high number of those communities lie in the San Joaquin Valley. And we reported on them and their struggles in our 2017 series, Contaminated. Last fall, a bill with a proposed solution passed the state Senate, but has since remained in limbo. FM 89's Carrie Klein has been following support and opposition to the bill and reports it's even dividing the San Joaquin Valley itself.
Last Wednesday, over 100 Valley residents traveled to Sacramento carrying bottles of water, bottles that were contaminated with bacteria and chemicals, just like the water that comes out of their taps.
If you don't believe us, come and join us and drink our water.
That's Lilia Garcia, a resident of Porterville, whose water is contaminated with uranium and nitrate. Isabel Solorio lives in Lanier, which has been trying to rid its drinking water of arsenic for over a decade.
Necesitamos una solución a largo plazo, no una bandita nada más.
We need a long-term solution, not a Band-Aid.
They and dozens of residents of communities like Arvin, Tonyville, and Lamont were at a legislative hearing. They spoke in support of Senate Bill 623, which would establish a fund to help communities like theirs obtain safe drinking water. It would make money available for capital costs, like water treatment plant construction, as well as long-term costs for operation, something no other pot of public money currently offers. The bill has some unusual bedfellows. It was co-authored by both Republicans and Democrats, and it's received broad support from both growers and environmental groups. But at the same Assembly subcommittee hearing where Garcia and Solorio supported the bill, many groups spoke out against it. The reason? The fund would come from a statewide tax on water bills, as well as fees on some growers. One group opposed is the city of Fresno. Kendra Dijogo of the Gualco Group spoke for the city.
We do agree that there is a need for safe drinking water, but we oppose the water tax. We do think that there are alternatives out there that should be vetted.
The city of Fresno wasn't alone. There was also the California Municipal Utilities Association, which represents water districts serving 70% of the state.
We very much support the intent of this budget change proposal and the trailer bill, but we do oppose water tax being as part of the funding package.
And many other water associations and local jurisdictions.
We don't agree with the means at this point.
We oppose how this bill is paid for.
Well, it would create a burden on local water agencies.
Jonathan Nelson of the Community Water Center, a nonprofit that's working to pass the bill, says opposition at the hearing didn't surprise him.
We expected them to be there. There are a lot of water agencies in the state. I think our hope is that we can continue the conversation and try to reach as many water agencies as possible.
But, he says, the fact that Fresno would oppose the bill is disappointing, given its proximity to so many of the communities struggling to access safe drinking water, especially since the bill has support from nearby Tulare County, the city of Porterville, and the mayor of Arvin.
If you are in the Central Valley, it seems to me that we have an extra special obligation to make sure we're joining hands together to ensure that all of our fellow Californians that live, reside, work in the Valley can have access to safe drinking water.
The main concern of opponents is a tax on every water user's water bill that would be capped at 95 cents per month. Nelson says that proposal was not made lightly and is the result of years of discussions. A state representative confirmed as much at last week's hearing. Here's a member of the Legislative Analyst's Office responding to a question from Kern County Assemblymember Vince Fong.
In terms of other alternatives, in terms of how to address this problem short of 623, is there, just spitballing, is there any other creative ideas?
Not that we've seen identified in other legislation.
Other alternatives exist, but for one reason or another aren't feasible. The money could come out of the state's general fund, but it'd be competing against other important programs like education and health and human services. There's also the polluter pays model, where a polluting business would pay to mitigate its impacts, but not all contamination has a clear man-made cause. Lawmakers took no action on SB 623 last week. They have until the end of August to move on it, though Nelson hopes they act by the state's budget deadline in mid-June. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. It's been a tough business climate for Valley dairy operators across Central California. The state's milk pricing scheme has been one problem, as well as additional regulatory pressure, and the fact that Californians are drinking less milk and buying fewer milk products. One of those dairy operators happens to be in Congress. Valley Representative David Valadao, Republican from Hanford, represents the 21st Congressional District, and he is the subject of some legal problems. Joining us now to tell us more, we have with us Brianna Calix from the Fresno Bee. Brianna, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
So the Triple V Dairy is an interest that David Valadao has with his brothers. They've recently been slapped with some lawsuits, though. How did this story develop? How did the Valadao family get involved with these legal problems?
Representative David Valadao obviously has a couple dairy operations, but he is involved with his family in this dairy Triple V. And the lawsuits are based, one in San Joaquin County, one in Fresno County. Probably the bigger lawsuit is from Rabobank, and Triple V Dairy had a couple credit lines with them that Rabobank is alleging we're not being paid on time, and so there is some debt there. And then the other one is from a animal nutrition company in San Joaquin County, and in that lawsuit they are also accusing Triple V Dairy of pretty much this company was delivering a bunch of product for the dairy and the dairy was not paying.
So these challenges that Triple V is facing right now, this is not just limited to California. They have operations in other states, as I understand it.
Right, and in Mexico, I believe.
Do we have an idea exactly how they got into this trouble? Is it just the overall problems the dairy industry is facing in recent years? The dairy operators up and down the state have been complaining about the state's milk pricing scheme for a while, saying it puts them at a disadvantage. What do we know about how this developed?
Well, we don't really know much. David Valadao didn't comment for my story, and neither did his brother, but they did talk to the Mercury News. And in the Mercury News' story, they did kind of pin this financial trouble on the dairy industry in California in general. And yeah, that's true. A lot of dairies, you know, they're not the only dairy that's been in trouble in Tulare County. Multiple other dairies have closed in the last couple years. So the industry is facing tough times, but not really sure why, you know, they're not paying on these debts.
So when it comes to Valadao, this also is interesting because there's been some reporting recently about the net worth of members of Congress. And with all these liabilities, I understand David Valadao ranked near the bottom on that list from the LA Times.
Right. He was the poorest member of Congress. And it was because of these debts and these liabilities, in particular, the money that he owed to Rabobank. And so, you know, which is the bank that's suing Triple V.
What do we know about their relationships and any other legal issues that the partners are facing?
Well, in the lawsuits, first in the Rabobank lawsuit, that one also named two other dairies. One of them was Lone Star and one of them was Two Star Dairy. And so those are dairies run by Valadao's relatives that are kind of having their own issues with Rabobank. And then in the other lawsuit, Lawley's, that lawsuit detailed a relationship between Valadao's cousin's husband, and his name is Frank Garcia, I believe, and he had a relationship, kind of a friendship with a Lawley's salesman, and so that's how they started doing business. And then the salesman was asking Mr. Garcia to, you know, kind of sign up for a line of credit with Lolly's, and kept giving him the application and he never filled it out. So that kind of sounds, it was just a business relationship that went bad.
His challenger, T.J. Cox, who's a Fresno area businessman, recently entered that race after running up against Jeff Denham in that district in the North Valley. He switched to run in the 21st district. T.J. Cox has faced some of his own legal challenges as well.
Right. In the past, you know, he had this management company that sold, it was a self-storage property to another company, and I think that company was kind of saying, like, hey, you sold us some storage buildings and with a leaky roof and a bunch of problems. And that actually went through an arbitration, and where a judge did order TJ Cox's company to pay up.
All right. Well, this case will play out in court again. The Triple V Dairy, which is one of the dairy companies where David Valadao has an ownership interest, facing significant lawsuits. And in this case, nearly $9 million of loans. Again, Brianna Kallix from the Fresno Bee joining us today. Brianna, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. A few weeks ago, Madera County District Attorney David Lynn announced he'll be running for re-election this November. In the meantime, however, he's involved in a public scandal, and he's claiming he's the victim. FM89's Carrie Klein has been following the saga and is here to give us an update. Carrie, welcome.
Hi, Joe.
This has been a really interesting one. Allegations of sexual harassment, corruption, a lawsuit, calls for resignation. How did this all begin? Take us back to last fall.
Yeah, there's so much drama. Okay, so this began back in November when it became public that there had been complaints against District Attorney David Lynn's behavior in the workplace and an investigation into it. And at a public meeting, the County Board of Supervisors took the opportunity to publicly censure him. There, they presented a 40-page, just this very long investigation report. It was done by a third-party law firm, and that report concluded that, yes, there was sufficient evidence to sustain the claims against Lynn. And those claims were that he had made lewd, aggressive, sexist, racist remarks in the workplace. They were pretty horrible, ranging from sexually explicit comments about coworkers, a lewd remark about a crime victim. There were racial slurs, the N-word. You name it. And most of them were corroborated by more than one witness that the law firm had interviewed.
And we should say, though, that District Attorney Lynn denies these remarks.
Yes, he denies all of them. And because of that, there is little recourse that the Board of Supervisors could do. So they had held this public meeting and censured him there because they can't fire him. They can't impeach him. They could recall him. But since there's an election in November, they're just gambling that voters will boot him out on their own. He's refused to resign. He does not deny all of these accusations, and he's actually referred to this censure as a show, as an inquisition, and a clear-cut obstruction of justice.
So that is where the story left off in November, mm-hmm. but things picked up again this year.
Yeah, in just the last couple of weeks. And the drama now revolves around Lynn's claims of corruption among the Madera County Board of Supervisors. So specifically, he's claiming that supervisors engaged in shady business deals with developers and with trash services providers in exchange for political contributions. Also claims that they inappropriately spent county funds.
Now, Lynn says that he started looking into these issues before the investigation into his alleged misdeeds in office, which again he denies, but he launched this investigation. We didn't hear much about any findings or any charges. In fact, there have been no charges filed in this investigation, but it popped up again in the news just a few days ago.
That's right. This has been one long he said, she said. So, you know, he said that he had at least threatened an investigation into these supervisors months ago. And then he claimed that his public censure was, in fact, retaliation for making those accusations. And also those accusations started against just two of the board members. And now he's making them against the entire board. And in the last couple of weeks, he's claimed that he's turned his investigation over to the state attorney general, Javier Becerra, and that Becerra, in fact, will be investigating all of these supervisors here at Madera County.
Certainly one could presume there could be a conflict of interest there, given the charges going back and forth. So going to the Attorney General would not be out of the question there. But have we heard anything from the Department of Justice, from the Attorney General on this investigation?
No, we have not. We have not. It's just far too soon. And they also don't comment on ongoing investigations.
And we should say that the Madera County Board of Supervisors, they also deny the charges that David Lynn has made. So that is one of the recent developments in this case.
Yeah, just
so
one of them.
Accusations against Lynn, a call for him to resign, and a public censure from the board. Now Lynn making the accusations against the board about corruption. But it's not over. What's the latest development?
It's not over. Simultaneously, DA Lynn appears to be getting ready to sue the county for damages and all of this. So he submitted a claim according to the California Tort Claims Act, which is the first step in filing a lawsuit against a government body. So he filed this claim in late February. It's actually he and his wife both filed this claim for a combined $15 million that they, you know, he claims that that the complaints by the Madera staff and also the investigation by this law firm contain false and inaccurate information. He claims that, you know, disclosing the information in a public hearing violated his right to due process. And the money here is he's claiming that he suffers from loss of reputation, from loss of future income, from bodily and emotional injury, from mental anguish. And he's asking for his legal fees and medical costs associated with all of that.
And I understand it's totals of quite a significant sum.
$15 million for both him and his wife. That's right.
So then what happens with this claim?
Well, so right now it's just been a claim. It's not a lawsuit just yet. When the district attorney filed it and then it was subsequently rejected by the county, from that date of rejection, he has 6 months to actually file a lawsuit. So we'll see if that actually happens. And the county is denying, all the major claims in his claim.
Fascinating story. Again, FM 89's Carrie Klein with us today. Carrie, thank you.
Thank you.
Doctors already ask us about how much we smoke and drink, our sex life, our diet. Should they also be asking about guns? It's a hotly debated question, as Capital Public Radio's Sammy Caiolo explains.
With mass shootings again in the national spotlight, some healthcare providers are wondering whether they can play a role in preventing acts of violence.
Many physicians have reached personal turning points. They can't stay on the sidelines anymore.
That's Dr. Garen Wintemute, director of the University of California Firearm Violence Research Center at UC Davis. He's not suggesting physicians screen all patients, just ones with major risk factors, like severe mental illness, substance addiction, suicidal thoughts, or a history of abuse. Once a doctor has the information, they can decide whether to intervene.
It is possible to involve family and obviously involve the person who's the topic of the discussion in a conversation about should the firearms be relocated temporarily, should they be dispensed of on a permanent basis.
Arthur Zrabinda is a doctor in Los Angeles and a member of the advocacy group Doctors for Responsible Gun Ownership. He says asking patients about guns is absolutely inappropriate.
This is a matter of personal choice and a personal privacy. It's none of the doctor's business what kind of guns the patient has, how many, and what they do with them.
He acknowledged that the question might be necessary in specific situations. In California, there's nothing restricting gun talk in the doctor's office, but a handful of other states have legal restrictions on what doctors can say about firearms. Wintemute is currently working with other agencies to help physicians understand how and when to have these conversations. In Sacramento, I'm Sammy Caiola.
Gin.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. A new project from Fresno-based jazz artist Benjamin Boone is getting national attention. It combines original compositions by the Fresno State professor and jazz saxophonist with the poetry of the late Pulitzer Prize winner and U.S. Poet Laureate Philip Levine, who died in 2015. It also features some of the top names in the jazz world as guest stars, including Branford Marsalis and Tom Harrell, as well as Valley Public Radio's own David Ouse. Levine was also known for his love of jazz and many of the poems on the CD, recorded by the poet live with the band, focus on jazz stars like John Coltrane and Charlie Parker. The CD was released last week, and for the occasion, we recently caught up with Benjamin Boone in Ghana, where he's spending the year as a visiting Fulbright professor at the University of Ghana. Benjamin, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much, Joe. It's such a joy to be reconnecting with marvelous, marvelous Fresno and all of my friends in Fresno.
How did you initially get connected with Mr. Levine?
Well, I first heard the name Philip Levine when I was sitting in a coffee shop in Asheville, North Carolina with my writer friend, Danny Foltzgray. It was 1999 or the spring of 2000. And I was looking over the job positions, and he was asking me what I was applying for. And I said, this one looks very interesting. It's California State University, which I know a lot about and has a great reputation. But I really don't know a lot about Fresno. What do you know about Fresno? And his eyes lit up. And he said, there's a job at Fresno State? And I said, yes. He said, that's where my favorite living poet lives, and if they can keep him for so many years, it must be a really good place. You have to apply. So that's actually the reason that I investigated the place further, and I ended up applying to California State University, Fresno. So I was hired in 2000 and had on my mind that I was going to meet Philip, and I was going to tell him about, you know, why I was there at Fresno State, and that my friend Danny said that he was his favorite living poet, and we never connected. And one time, the dean or assistant dean, Jose Diaz, had said there was going to be a fundraiser and would I play while Philip read poetry, and I was so excited, but then because of bad weather, it ended up being canceled. So I missed meeting Philip at that point. But then I was so happy that Dixie Salazar and Sasha Coca decided to have a fundraiser for Fresno Filmworks. This was 2012, and they decided to call it The Poetry of Jazz, The Jazz of Poetry, or something very similar. So they asked me if I would perform. Peter Everwine would be reading a set. They wanted me to do some music, and they wanted Philip to read his poetry. So that was the initial vision of the project. But light bulbs went off in my head, and I thought, my goodness, if I'm going to be able to meet Philip and share a program with him, we have to collaborate. So I talked to Sasha about that, and she put us together, and I met Philip. We talked about it. I found out that Philip had been a jazz aficionado for most of his life. He went to school with people like Kenny Burrell, and one of his teachers actually was Harold McGee, who was the trumpet player on the session of Charlie Parker, where he did the dial recording of Lover Man. And if you watch the movie Bird, that's where he's so intoxicated that he can't even stand up to play. And Harold McGee is holding him up so that he can even play and be recorded. It's a very, very famous recording. And so Philip heard that story not from the news, not from other people. He heard it from the guy who was in the studio and drove Charlie Parker back to his motel, where he ended up lighting fire to it and being put in an insane asylum. So Phil was in touch with musicians. He was in touch with the music. He loved the music. He loved the players. He was extremely knowledgeable about all of the different CDs. We just had a wonderful time getting to know each other. And a consequence of us talking so much about players and albums was that we didn't rehearse. I had actually asked him for this concert that we should collaborate. I said, Phil, we should collaborate on this. He's like, oh, I'd love to collaborate. I love jazz, and I think it would be wonderful to do. And then we ended up talking about music and musicians. And the other times we spoke, it ended up always going back to music and musicians. And finally, it was getting time for the concert, and we had chosen the poems that we were going to do and collaborate on. And I said, Philip, I think that we should rehearse. It would make me feel so much better if we would rehearse. And he said, Ben, we don't need to rehearse. What could go wrong? And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, there's so many things that could go wrong. I'd done arrangements and I'd sort of planned how things would go, and his tempo might be a little bit different than what I had imagined. And, you know, lots of things can go wrong. And I said, well, Philip, can't you, I mean, please, let's run through it at least one time so we know what's going to happen. I'll never forget, there are certain moments that just are like they were yesterday. So I'm telling you about this, and I see him looking deep in my eyes. It's not how most people look in your eyes. I think he was seeing through my fear and through my anxiety and my insecurity, and he looked really deep in my eyes, and he smiled, and he said, Ben, tell you what, I'll come to the dress rehearsal, and maybe we can run through it then. And so I was happy about that. So we had our rehearsal, we had things planned, and then the dress rehearsal comes, and guess what? There's no Philip Levine. And so we do our run through. People are trying to get in touch with him. It doesn't work. And then fast forward about an hour and a half, and we're backstage, and Dixie comes back to our dressing room and says, Ben, it's about 5-10 minutes till we're supposed to start, and Philip's not here. And so I'm wondering if we're even going to do a collaboration. I don't know what's happened to Phil, right? So the show starts. Peter Everwine comes on, and he does an absolutely fabulous, fabulous, fabulous reading. And then they announce Phil, and Phil comes up on stage and reads a few of his poems. And that was the first time that I knew that Philip was in the house. Then we played some instrumentals. I think we played 3 instrumentals. And then I hadn't spoken to Philip since he arrived. And so I was on the microphone and said, well, we're kind of flying by the seat of our pants right now, but I think now would be a good time to start a collaboration with Philip Levine. And everyone laughed, and Philip came up on stage. I know this because I listened to a recording of that concert last night, because the Paris Review asked me to write an essay about my collaboration with Phil and how it started. So I went back in time, 8 years, and listened to this concert. And Philip came up on stage. People were applauding like crazy. And I said, so Philip, what should we do? Should we do the one about? And he said, let's do Let Me Begin Again. And so then we started. And in listening to the concert these many years later, what I realize is that at the very beginning of the reading, he read like all poets do. He was doing his reading, and we were doing things behind him. But as we went through those 5 poems of his, with each one he was listening more and more carefully to the band. And by the last 2, the 5th from the end was Yaakov, which is a marvelous, marvelous poem. And that was really fully arranged. I had written out a lot of music to that and had the timings and stuff in my head. And he started reading that, and he was leaving space for the band to comment. He was really listening to the group, and it was like he was a member of the band. And he was saying in his pauses, I want you to comment on what I've just done. And so we did. And that was fabulous, and I got chill bumps. And I still can remember getting the chill bumps, thinking, this is really special. You need to catalog this in your mind. But then I also, simultaneously, thought, oh my gosh, this arrangement's not going to work because he's taking so much longer to read than I had anticipated. So I turn and I tell the band, you know, cycle A to B until I cue you. And we did it like that for the next 2 poems, because then we were really jamming together. And that was the beginning of the collaboration. And if I compare, all of those 5 poems are on the CD. But all of the music is different. And it's different because we figured out through experience how to make a synergy between the poetry and the music.
Was it a challenge to then convince him to go into the studio and then take this to the next level in that sense?
That wasn't a difficulty at all. After the concert, there were so many people that wanted to talk to Philip that he was surrounded by admirers. And so I was signing CDs, actually. I had a CD that had just come out. So we actually didn't talk after the concert. I ended up having a glass of wine with Peter Everwine and Dixie and some of the other people. But Philip and I hadn't spoken. So a few weeks later, or a week later or so, I called him and said, you know, I really appreciate the collaboration. It would be fun to do this again. Let's try and do it again. And Philip said, I know this because I took notes on it because I was so happy about the way the conversation went. He said, well, the Library of Congress asked me to do something, and I said, why don't we fly the band out and we'll do something at the Library of Congress? So I was on cloud nine. I was terrified to give him a call, but it really was wonderful. And in that same conversation, you know, I said, well, Philip, maybe we should try to put some of this down. We should work on it some more. I wasn't happy with the way that my arrangements were. I think I can do better. And I'd love the opportunity to really refine the arrangements. And then we can try it again and record. And let's just see what it sounds like. And he was eager to do it. And then I said, well, Philip, I know you're really busy. You're traveling all over the place, giving workshops and readings, so we could make it easy. The band could record the tracks, and then you could record on top of the tracks. And he sounded irritated by that. And he said, Ben, why would I want to do that? I've been in studios and been in the dark recording by myself many times. Why would I want to do that? That doesn't sound like fun. What sounds like fun to me is if the band is there and we record it with the band. You do that, and then let's do it. So when he came to the studio, he was very, very happy. He was gracious. We had a great time. There was a great rapport between him and the different musicians and the engineers, and we just had a great time. So after we had done some recording, I've played at the Rogue Festival for many, many years consecutively, and I asked Philip if he would want to join us and want to do a couple of his poems. And he said that he'd be happy to, but he only felt like doing a couple of the poems. And I said, that's fine, no problem, that's great, thank you, this will be so much fun. So I went on KVPR and you interviewed me, and you asked the question, what is it like to work with Philip Levine? And my response was something along the lines that it's actually terrifying, because here's a man whose poetry is respected the world over, who's won all of these awards, and I'm trying to add to that in some meaningful way, and the pressure is very great because I could screw it up. So he sent me an email, and he said, he listened to that broadcast, and he emailed me, and he said, I love you and Joe, you're great, but please, terrifying? I can't even terrify my cat, nonetheless my grandchildren.
That is a great story. I want to talk about a few of the tracks on this CD, a few of the poems that you wrote the music to arrange this. I want to start with, I think, what might be my favorite, and that's Gin, a very dry sense of humor that Philip conveys in this poem about young boys first experiencing their taste of this forbidden liquor. You have Karen Margoth involved in this recording as well, in addition to Phil. Tell me about how this came together and what stands out for you in that particular piece.
I'm really happy that you like the track Gin, because that probably was the most synergistic of any of the tracks and probably the most fun for us to record. I happen to love that poem too, because all of us that are listening, that are over that age, that are adults, have been through a period of time where we wanted to feel big, where we felt insecure, where we were trying to find ourselves. And that, to me, is part of what the poem is about. And then it's also maybe what drinking too much gin does to you when you're an adult. But there's a real humorous side to the poem that I think we all can relate to. So I asked Karen Margoth to do several tracks, actually, with Phil. We ended up recording 29 tracks, and I think Karen has owned 3 or 4 of those because I'm such a fan of her voice. And I wanted her to scat. And part of the reason I invited her to be a part of this is that the poem talks about young girls. And so I wanted a feminine voice to be included in this in some way, shape, or form. And she's such a fabulous, not only singer, she's a fabulous scatter. So she's in the control room, and Phil's in an isolation room, and the drummer's in the main hall. I think it was Brian Hamada. And then I'm in another isolation booth. We all have headphones on. And Phil starts reading. And I think Karen hadn't been able to look over the poem prior to the session. So Phil starts to read the poem. And on when he says, you know, it must be hair tonic, she starts giggling. And we all hear the giggles in our headphones, and that makes us all giggle, right? And then as Phil keeps reading, and there are more and more punchlines, and Phil delivers the punchlines with perfect, perfect comedic timing, if you listen to how he did it. There's a great line, something about, yes, he was very well read for a kid. She just started howling in the headphones, and we kept going. We kept playing, but it affected our playing, and it affected Phil's reading, and he was smiling. And we had just a great time. And that tune is the epitome of us jamming together, because the only thing on that track that I wrote down and I put on paper is the melody. There's no chords. There's no indication of what to do after the melody is done. It's all freeform. It's all complete improvisation and us listening to each other and weaving in and out. And Karen kept it together enough to, you know, sing. She wasn't just laughing. She was singing, but in between laughed. And I can't recall, actually, if we kept one of her laughs in there. I think we did keep one of the laughs in there, but we ended up editing out the other giggles and laughs. But it was a very, very special poem. It's a very special reading, and I think that was the last session that we did with Phil, and I remember it very, very vividly, and I'm really glad that someone that is such a music lover like you likes that track.
You also recorded several of Philip's poems that are about jazz titans, Clifford Brown, Sonny Rollins. Tell me about those. How did those come together, especially with some of the co-stars that you eventually added to the project?
Well, I knew that I wanted to record the poems Philip had written, not only about music, but about the jazz greats. I knew I wanted to do that when we decided this was going to be a CD. And I ended up recording those tracks. I remember Clifford isn't an easy tune to play. And I practiced and rehearsed and was ready when the recording session came. And I was really happy with how I played. But I vividly remember sitting in the editing booth, and I saw the track name. I remember Clifford. And then I heard an alto saxophone. And Clifford Brown is a trumpet player. And even in the poem, it says the clear trumpet of Clifford Brown. And here you hear an alto saxophone. And that was a moment I just had to swallow all of my ego about what I had done and how proud I was of my playing on that track and say, no, this is wrong. This is about Clifford Brown. This needs to be a trumpet, first of all. And second of all, not just any trumpet. It needs to be someone who is profoundly influenced by Clifford Brown and has carried that playing tradition and musical tradition forward. And so that's when I was able to get Tom Harrell to record the track. He recorded that in New York at Systems 2, and the microphone that he used to record that track is John Coltrane's personal RCA microphone on loan from his son Ravi Coltrane. Chris Potter recorded on the same microphone, if your listeners are interested. With Sonny Rollins, Chris Potter gets such a big, wonderful sound that is obviously channeling Sonny Rollins. And then Greg Osby, to me, is the epitome of what Charlie Parker would have sounded like had he lived past his very, very young age. And Branford Marsalis put out a DVD that really inspired me many, maybe 15 years ago. It was a DVD about John Coltrane, and he played these Coltrane tunes, and there was a version of Giant Steps that just blew my mind. And so it made sense to have him do the poem that was referencing a John Coltrane solo. So all of those artists were very eager to do the project. They were really happy about being able to do something different. I don't know if any of them had worked with words before and worked with poetry, and they all were fans of the poems and thought the poems were really great homages to those jazz greats. So it really just all fell together very easily.
So Philip passed away in 2015. You continued working on this project. Did he ever give you a sense of what he thought of the work to the degree it was complete when you left the studio, or, you know, in that intervening time before he died in 2015?
Philip approached the project in this way. I would ask him, hey, would you like to come to the studio and hear while we mix this track? And his response was typically something like, well, Ben, this is your project. You do it, and you do what you think is the right thing to do. But he did hear some of the tracks. He heard Our Valley, and I think he heard Jen and some of the others, and he was really happy with it. He sounded like a really happy kid who was getting to play in the mud for a while. But he didn't micromanage at all any of the mixing process or the editing process, and he really just trusted that I would do that, which was terrifying to me and remarkable and empowering on the other hand. He did give some guidance into how, you know, what he liked and what he didn't like. He wasn't passive by any means. There was one tune that I had written a guitar part for, and he heard that and said, oh, no guitar on this. So he didn't do it. He really liked the accompaniment of Our Valley when he heard it, and so that meant that I wrote a melody to it and did more things with it. The one that he gave the absolute most feedback on was They Feed They Lion. He said that he wanted to do it much differently than he ever had done it before, that he wanted it to really boil, and he wanted the listener to get a sense that something was going to happen later and things were going to explode, and he wanted his voice to be more angry and more, I can't think of the word. He wanted his voice to be more angry and there to be more imperative, I think, to the reading than before. So when we went in the studio, I think that in that particular session, that was the last tune of the day, and his voice was tired, and we knew he was tired. And I said, Philip, well, do you want to do this tune? He said, yeah, I have to do it. Let's do it. And so he went into the booth, and he gave it his all. And that's a first take on Philip's part. That's a definite first take, because that's all he had. And he did it, and he exhausted himself, and he exhausted his voice. And I think it's a really forceful, compelling reading in it. His reading, you hear in his voice a tenseness and an anger that has been repressed, but it's going to just burst forth. And he also said that he wanted a saxophone solo in between the stanzas, and that it would get a little bit crazier and crazier as it went on, but otherwise it would simmer until the very end when things would just boil over into a riot. So if you listen to that track, I think that's what you'll hear. He also gave direction on A Dozen Dawn Songs Plus One. I got an email from him, and it said, you know, this is a poem that's been sitting around for a while. I haven't ever read it in public. I think it needs music. And so that presented a compositional challenge to me, because it's a really long poem. It's 13 stanzas, and the scenes change, but it's all about misery. It's about repression. It's about working in jobs you don't like. It's unhappiness. So how do you keep that underlying emotion going and sustaining for, I think the track is almost 10 minutes. So Philip really wanted, we agreed on the core emotion, and Philip really wanted that tune to be recorded. So I think that's the only time that he read that poem in public or recording was on this recording.
It's a fascinating new project. The CD is called The Poetry of Jazz, a collaboration between Fresno-based jazz artist and saxophonist and composer Benjamin Boone and Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, U.S. Poet Laureate Philip Levine, who passed away in 2015, both longtime Fresno State professors. The new CD also features Valley Public Radio's own David Aus on piano, as well as jazz greats including Greg Osby, Chris Potter, Tom Harrell, and Branford Marsalis. It is available on Origin Records, and Benjamin Boone joining us today on the phone from the University of Ghana, where he is visiting this year as a Fulbright Scholar. Benjamin, congratulations on the CD, and thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's been an absolute delight.
What work is? We stand in the rain in a long line, waiting at Ford Highland Park.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Farmers and scientists in the Sacramento region are working together to help boost salmon populations in California rivers. But Capital Public Radio's Ezra David Romero reports they are doing something a little different, growing creepy crawly critters.
Jacob Katz is on the hunt, but not for geese or ducks on this rice farm about 40 minutes north of Sacramento. With an aquarium net in hand, he's on the lookout for bugs.
So we're going bug hunting. You can see that this water is just slightly turbid. There's a little bit of wind. Dip this net into the water, and it just comes out literally full of bugs.
Katz is a scientist with California Trout, a conservation group with a focus on protecting wild fish.
Wow. These are mostly cladocerans. We call them water fleas.
We're at River Garden Farms, founded in 1913. They grow things like corn, wheat, and a lot of rice, the kind of rice local sushi restaurants use. The farm has partnered with California Trout and UC Davis on a pilot project to create what they call floodplain fatties, a nickname for the well-fed baby salmon and smelt who will eat their bugs in the Sacramento River.
These little bugs are floating fillet for salmon that will be in the river.
The reason they're doing this? Young Chinook salmon and other fish need help. Much of the water they need to survive is now stored in dams and diverted through thousands of miles of levees. The project's in year two, and the end goal is to improve the likelihood that salmon survive the trek to the ocean and back.
What farmers are doing is reconnecting that floodplain natural wealth to the river system where it's needed. More fish equals a win-win for everybody.
Roger Cornwell with River Garden Farms says it all starts with rice paddies. As general manager, he's used to flooding fields during the off-season to provide a rest stop for millions of birds along the Pacific Flyway. Now, instead of just letting the water soak into the earth, he's made a change that mimics the natural floodplain of the Sacramento River.
We're creating fish food. It's very simple. We just pump the water in, let it slow down, and it starts to break down the carbon that's there, creates algae. Algae create bugs. Then we pump that right back to the river to feed the fish.
So far, 12 farmers are growing bugs on about 50,000 acres in the Sacramento area. That's about 70 pounds of bugs per acre foot of water. The group is figuring out the details about exactly how to get that fish food back into the river on a large scale. They hope to ramp up the project with as many rice farms as possible in years to come. But Cornwell says kinks still need working out.
I think for the farmer, it's more of how effectively can we get food to the fish. We've got to have all the processes figured out to make it easy for everybody to implement.
Carson Jeffries is an aquatic biologist with UC Davis. He and Jacob Katz published a study last year that suggests that when farmers and conservationists work together, there could be more fish. He says this project eliminates the popular farms versus fish argument.
It's through that relationship with the farmers that we have the most potential for future success, as opposed to standing with our heads in the sand. This is getting us to a place where we can actually have real impacts and change over time.
Back on the rice farm, Roger Cornwell is about to release the bug-rich water into the Sacramento River through a system of pumps and canals.
This water's been out here for right at 3 weeks right now, and so we'll let some out now.
For Cornwell, who's farmed in the region for over a decade, the Science Farm partnership cost him about $45 per acre.
We're stepping out of our comfort zone. As this grows, people will see what we're doing, and then we can start developing trust among neighbors. And then this program's just going to take off on its own.
He says the minimal cost is worth it to save fish and to make sure the acreage is around for future generations. In Sacramento, I'm Ezra David Romero.
And that does it for today's Valley Edition. As always, we want to know what you think. You can send us your comments, thoughts on the program via email. Our address is talk@kvpr.org. You can also connect with us on Twitter. We are at KVPR and at Valley Edition. And find us on Facebook as well. Let's search Valley Public Radio there and on Instagram as well. You can also subscribe to our podcast and get all of our audio archives when you're on our website, kvpr.org, and catch our recent broadcast from our Be Public Live series, a Facebook Live broadcast of our community forum that Carrie Klein hosted last week about air quality and air pollution in the San Joaquin Valley. That's also up on our website, kvpr.org. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Laura Tsutsui, reporters Carrie Klein and Christina Lopez, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2019 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvine.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org. And the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.